Times, of course, are very different now than 25 years ago when we brought Red Hot and Rio into the world. Music is now freely and effortlessly streamed across borders. We're a global community of individual microcultures, very loosely held together by shared playlists and social media. The traditional symbiotic relationship between record labels and mass media is over. So the means to awareness is complicated and scattered, and the creative use of social media is critical to getting the word out. But in this age of political and social divisions, for me, music is the only art form whose fundamental nature is designed to bring people together. I think all of the Red Hot projects have accomplished that superbly. And with streaming, if rights issues can be sorted out, there's not a danger of anything going out of print. I'm always optimistic when it comes to music.
Twenty-five years after the release of Red Hot and Rio, the challenges are still here. Brazilian and global health systems are going through very unstable moments. And more than ever, artists can help support and transform these scenarios. Different from 1996, today all artists can amplify their voices through their social media outlets, directly impacting their audiences. How can they use this power? How's the current scene of artists impacting future generations? Red Hot and Rio 25 Music Activism is a docu-podcast produced by the pro-social creative production company Red Hot Organization that dives into the creative universe of the Red Hot and Rio album released in 1996, a project that gathered funds and raised awareness for the fight against the HIV epidemic, involving major pop music stars recreating bossa nova themes with modern electronic elements, inspired by the trip-hop and chill-out scenes that became popular around the world at the time of the album's release. Throughout three episodes, we will retrace Red Hot's history in the early 90s political-cultural context and its parallel with the present time, and the social and musical impact caused by the production. This is episode 3 in English. You can also check the Portuguese version of this episode.
The album stands up very well a quarter century on, I think, and again, I attribute that to the timeless hipness of Brazilian music's adaptability to the new while retaining its essence. And of course, there's the eternal beauty of the melodies, Jobim front and center, but also his children, so to speak, Caetano Veloso, Gilberto Gil, Chico Buarque, Maria Bethânia, and others who grew bossa nova into Tropicália and MPB.
On our previous podcast episode, we've discussed the creative universe and stories behind the music. Universal's director, Chuck Mitchell, opened that episode by sharing how the project reverberated and its contribution to the artistic scene.
My impression is, what I hear now, is that the record took a few years to come into the Brazilian consciousness. Again, it was sort of the beginning of the internet, so there were no blogs, there were no real online radio stations, there was no real underground, there was, you know, it was hard to find, it was just a CD that you could only find in a few places. There was some nice pieces, there was some press, but it didn't become a phenomenon in Brazil. But now, 25 years later, I was just having a meeting with a friend, and he told me, it changed my life back then, you know. He said it was like the Sgt. Pepper's record for his generation. It was like, oh my God, we could do all this with Brazilian music? You know, people woke up and says, I can do crazy stuff with Brazilian classics. And again, it was the cusp of changing the appreciation of Brazilian music amongst young people. When I was growing up in Brazil, you would go to a party or to a club or to a bar, it was all foreign music. It was English pop and US pop. And now you go to a club and a bar in Brazil and it's 97% Brazilian music. You don't go to a party in São Paulo and listen to UK pop. Very little. And it's all Brazilian. So it's in that level, it was very successful. And musically, artistically, it was very successful.
So every Red Hot project sort of has a double intent. One is this sort of curatorial, artistic, how do we make the best record? How do we just create something new and beautiful in the world? And then the other is, how do we do good? How do we have a positive social impact? So I've been talking to a professor at NYU recently who has a joint appointment in music and in public health, which is sort of those same parallels. And he's taught me something really important, which I now helps me understand the past better. He said, you always have to talk about how did you change the narrative and how did you change behavior? So I look back at like Red Hot and Blue and I said, yes, we were changing the narrative around the LGBTQ community globally, and we were changing behavior around safer sex. And I think when Red Hot and Rio is very interesting to see in the same lens, where we're changing the narrative about Brazilian music, Brazilian culture, its importance, but we're also trying to change behavior in terms of this ongoing fight against HIV and practicing safer sex, which at the time when this came out was still kind of raging. And people weren't really talking about it in South America, in Latin America. So Red Hot and Rio was really meant to be pushing into that realm.
John Carlin and Beko Drenofi shared their perspective about Red Hot and each project's mission. How powerful it is when artists understand the power, the reach, and the influence of their work when aimed in the right direction.
I'm aware of the great Fela Kuti's quote that music is the weapon of the future, but for me, music is always the voice of the present. No matter when it was first made, it's alive at the moment you hear it.
I think that artists and music's involvement in social causes can still generate a big impact with all the sort of current mass information overload. It's very hard to cut through the noise when it comes to information, or should I say misinformation. Everybody now is their own self-publisher. It used to be that you would have to write a book or broadcast in some way to get your message out there. And now through social media, it's totally democratized the whole process, which is great because it gives people the platform that they need. But the problem is, you know, you can't give a megaphone to everybody because not everybody is going to talk sense through that megaphone. But I do believe that there is room for musicians and artists to support a cause and make a difference.
After Chuck Mitchell, we heard Maurice Bernstein from New York's Giant Step, reinforcing the idea that artists have immeasurable power to mobilize audiences, and their art sheds a different sensibility to social causes. Their silence as well. And here, we can also listen to the singer Bebel Gilberto highlighting the artist's power and responsibility.
Having the power to affect people on social media, through music, through books, articles, is the only way we all can inform better people. I think the whole thing that's going on, for in my understanding, is a lack of communication and lack of understanding and education. And people are raised in different perspectives, and sometimes they don't really have the chance to see the world in a different side. I have to say, I am in a beautiful and privileged family that always were very in alert and you know, had a knowledge of politics and sociopolitics and how important it is to use the power of your voice if you are somehow important in today's day, celebrity or a well-known person. I do think is the best way to communicate and spread the truth or at least the vision that you have. And when artists tell this to people that love the music, sometimes they like to hear their thoughts too. So I encourage everyone, and I always do my best to inform and share all my thoughts with everyone all the time.
The world is upside down, right? We live in an entirely different world with the triumph of neoliberalism and market fundamentalism and the idea that everything can and should be bought and sold. And so the spaces for public discourse, for public policymaking, and for a different vision of collaboration between the public and private sector have shrunk alongside massive disinvestments by governments in public health. And I'm talking, of course, not just about Brazil, but about the United States.
Dr. Kendall Thomas, professor at New York's Columbia Law School, has been involved in humanitarian causes for over 20 years, including being part of the ACT UP movement. Dr. Thomas also studies Brazilian culture and society and gave us his perspective and parallels on both pandemics, HIV and COVID-19.
I've had with people this time last year seeking to draw from the lessons of HIV/AIDS and use them to understand and offer concrete proposals for how to respond to the pandemic. On the one hand, there are many similarities. On the whole, I'm struck by the radical differences between the public health response and just the public response to HIV/AIDS and COVID-19. I mean, the triumph of a certain viral individualism and the fraying of the idea of common good and the rise of libertarianism, of market libertarianism, as the only way people understand themselves and their relationship to other people. These are ideological, economic, and cultural forces that are impossible to contend with.
Do I see any sort of correlation between the sort of misinformation and propaganda to try and get people to use condoms back in the 90s when we had the AIDS epidemic? Do I see a correlation between that and mask wearing and the misinformation about that? Yes, in many ways, because both of them are a prophylactic. It's a protection. It's protecting you against harm. You know, unfortunately, masks are now a part of our everyday life, and I think they're going to continue to be for a long time, and we need to take that seriously, because the pandemic will subside, as the Spanish flu did, but I think we're going to see masks as a part of our everyday life, you know, similar to when you go to Asia and you're riding the subway in China or Japan, everybody's wearing masks. So it's here to stay, but I think, like anything, we're going to find an elegant way to execute our mask wearing, and it'll just become a part of our attire, just like a pair of shoes or a jacket's become.
The work that the language of music can do, that no other language on the face of the earth can do. Because, I mean, it's a cliche, but music truly is universal. I think that's because, you know, the foundation of music is the drum, right? And, you know, the bossa nova is, it's not recognized as a black music, but you know as well as I that without samba, there would be no bossa nova, right? So the use of these black diasporic musics is particularly meaningful to me, right? And so I'm delighted to be part of this 25th anniversary celebration of the Red Hot and Hugh. Let's get the word right. Red Hot, or we'd say, Heji Hochi e Hugh.
As just reinforced by Dr. Kendall, Red Hot and Rio was a forward-thinking project on many levels, musically, socially, racially, and culturally. And the music never stops. Music is the global language that impacts and transforms, the weapon to build the future.
1996 was a year that I went onto the board of the Gay Men's Health Crisis here in New York, which was also the year that Red Hot and Rio broke. But Gay Men's Health Crisis worked with Red Hot and organized parties and dances where the artists on, I forget the name of the dance project. It might have been the second or third one.
Red Hot and Dance.
Yeah. You know, it became a platform for people coming together. So it was education, prevention, and treatment. That were highlighted, or the conversations and work could be done around those things using the music as a platform. As you know, I love music. I make music. You've heard me sing. I very much think that music is an important tool for promoting social justice literacy, but also health literacy, political literacy. The Red Hot and Rio project, you know, it took bossa nova and used that music, which is a music of, you know, sun and fun and the beach and love and all that kind of thing, to both express and communicate a message to the world, really, because that project, I think it was your second most successful project in the series, you know, that went global, right? It was like a second wave of the first wave of bossa nova when it broke with Chega de Saudade, right? It was that kind of cultural event.
I think our mission now is to do still very cool and meaningful projects that come across, you know, and still bring a positive message and a positive spin on these very dark issues that now affects literally all of us in this planet. It's not a niche disease or a niche, you know, underground situation. This is a planetary situation that I think we're going to continue addressing years to come.
So let me say one last thing to that point, because I think it's important. Red Hot does not do the thing that we think will be the most popular crossover. Sometimes we do the hard things, that we choose to do a project because it needs to be done. So we did a Fela Kuti tribute album, not because we thought African music was going to sell in the United States, but because, well, Fela Kuti died of AIDS. And at that moment, AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa was raging. It still is. So even with like Red Hot and Rio, we thought it would be popular. We had George Michael and Sting and Everything But the Girl. But we also did it because it was the right thing to do at that moment. It was the thing that the world needed to know, that this was a global pandemic and that it was affecting people in Brazil. It was affecting people everywhere.
Beku and John and Red Hot's small global team continue to formulate the same question. What needs to be done? How can we raise awareness, shed light, and bring light affirming information and transformation where needed? After the amazing Red Hot and Rio released in 1996, over 20 thematic projects have been conceived and produced by the Red Hot team. Projects involving all musical genres, artists, cultures around the world. In 2011, Red Hot and Rio 2 was releasing, including the participation of over 60 artists. But that's the focus for our next podcast series.
I want to wish Red Hot and Rio a very happy 25th anniversary, and long may you reign.
This is an original podcast series produced by the Red Hot Organization and CLAV. Produced and directed by Beck Udranoffi and John Carlin. Created and written by Pedro Pontorin. Sound design, editing, and mix by Conrado Lima. Narrated by Cayena. Executive producer, Pedro Almeida. Artwork by Alexandre Ferrari. Production assistant, Kelly Gelberg. Special thanks to all artists and interviewees, the extended Red Hot team, Verve Records, Universal Music, and everyone who has contributed, giving us testimonials for this podcast. For more information and to keep posted on Red Hot projects, please check www.redhot.org and join Red Hot on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.